This is The Takeaway for Monday, November 27th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We hope you had a fine Thanksgiving holiday. You know, they're headed back to work in Washington today, too, and Congress is staring down the barrel of a confrontational December. There's a tax bill. There's going to be a spending fight that is already oozing with threats of a government shutdown. There's a Russia investigation, a surreal election in Alabama, and it's all happening while retiring Republicans bash President Trump and question what their party has become.
When the next generation asks us, why didn't you do something? What are we going to say? I rise today to say enough.
I don't know why he lowers himself and debases our country in the way that he does, but he does.
We're getting nothing done, my friends. We're getting nothing done.
Next week, we're going to talk about the future of a Republican Party that many members say is dying under the leadership of President Trump. But this week, we look at the Democrats. Their struggle is much different than the Republicans. Their party isn't dying, but it is searching for an identity after a loss in 2016 and hundreds of lost seats over the last decade. Who does the Democratic Party represent? How far left should Democrats swing to embrace the energy of young progressives and people of color? And how can Democrats claim to be the party that defends women's rights if lawmakers like Senator Al Franken and Congressman John Conyers, both accused of sexual harassment, don't resign? What's the future of the Democratic Party? We begin that search with the face of the progressive movement in America.
Hi, this is Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. Now, a lot of Democrats, including some of you, say, why talk to Sanders at all? After all, Bernie Sanders, not a Democrat, but an independent who ran for president in the Democrats' primary. It's true, Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat, but he is having an enormous impact on the party. Right now, behind the scenes, Sanders supporters are fighting it out with establishment Democrats over internal rules of the Democratic Party. And on the outside, Sanders is the one pulling Democrats to the left and urging the party to embrace liberal economics in a time of stagnant wages and income inequality.
All over this country, we saw young people and working people, many of them first-time candidates, getting involved in politics and winning elections for school board, for city council, for state legislature. What I can tell you is our revolution, the group that came out of my campaign, ran six state legislative candidates in Virginia. Three of them won, including knocking off one of the leading powerhouses in the Republican leaders in the legislature. Two lost and one is in a recount. These were new candidates, never before involved in electoral politics. So I think what you're seeing around this country and what is enormously important for the future of the Democratic Party and our country is more and more people getting involved in running for office. But if we have another election, midterm election, as we had 4 years ago, where 36% of the people voted, then the future of the Democratic Party in the country is not good. We need people involved, standing up, voting, and fighting back.
Well, these three seats that candidates have won in Virginia that you mentioned, and maybe some more if some are in recount, Senator, that's three against 1,000 seats since 2009 that Democrats have lost in legislatures, local races, and national races across the country. Where did the DNC go wrong after 2008 that has caused this bleed?
Todd, that is, I think, a very important question. And it's 1,000 legislative seats that were lost. It's the U.S. House of Representatives lost, the U.S. Senate lost, the White House lost. And I think any objective person, fair-minded person, has got to conclude that the model, the strategy, the efforts of the Democratic Party for the last many years have failed. And we have to rethink the direction in which the party is going to go forward. I think it is absolutely fair to say, and it's hard for anybody to deny, that for many years now, the Democratic Party has been a top-down party, not a bottom-up party, not a party which really has wanted to open its doors to young people and to working people. And all of this, Todd, takes place within the context of a Republican Party moving very far to the right, a party which 2 months ago wanted to throw 30 million people off of health care, as of today wants to give massive tax breaks to billionaires, a party which has an agenda way out of touch with where the American people are. Why do Democrats continue to lose? Why in half the states in America does the Democratic Party not have any presence at all? You got states controlled by the House, the Senate, governor's office controlled by right-wing Republicans. So there has to be a fundamental rethinking of the direction of the Democratic Party. My view, very strongly, is open the doors. Get working people in. Make it a 50-state party. I think there are fundamental reforms at the DNC that need to take place. For example, does anybody think it makes sense that in the presidential primary process, over 700 votes go to superdelegates, 30% of what a candidate needs to get the nomination? Does that make sense? I don't think so. Does it make sense that you have states like in New York State, you have to register as a Democrat 6 months before the primary? I think we need to move to open primaries. I think we need to reform the caucus process so that everybody can vote, not just those who could show up at the caucus time. And I think we need a lot more transparency at the DNC. Many millions of dollars go through the DNC. I'm not sure that people know how that money is being spent. I would hope that every sane member of the party understands that if we're going to win, if we're going to defeat Trumpism, if we're going to be strong in every state in this country, we cannot continue the top-down status quo approach that has been in existence for so many years.
You know, when you go to your supporters within the party, though, Senator, and you hear from some of them that they are willing to leave if the party doesn't come around to these reforms. Look, we all know how negotiations go. Maybe some of them would leave, some of them wouldn't. But you mentioned Donald Trump. You know, Donald Trump is widely viewed by many establishment Republicans as strangling the GOP, bringing populist candidates, bringing primaries against incumbents. The politics are very different, but a lot of Democrats, I have to say, view you in the same way. The polls are stretching the two parties right now, and either Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders or both are going to break them. That's what people say.
Well, Todd, this is what I think. I think many, many millions of people understand that something is fundamentally wrong in this country. What is a quid is a question is listening to where the people are, responding to the needs of ordinary people, telling people that they have power when they stand together and they're prepared to take on big money interests. So I am encouraged as I go around the country to see a whole lot of people, working people, young people, beginning to get involved. And that will absolutely mean transforming the Democratic Party, making it to a party of working people, of young people, not simply a party dominated by wealthy campaign contributors.
Is big dollar fundraising dead, Senator Sanders? You were out on the campaign trail. Everybody remembers $27. It was one of your buzzwords. But you set records for low dollar individual donations. Is that really the wave of the future? Can an American national campaign survive without big money?
I believe it can. You know, I rejected a super PAC, and I always will. And I think what the Democrats have got to say is we're going forward with a progressive agenda. And we're not going to have billionaire campaign contributors telling us that that is not a good idea, because those are not the people who will dictate the future direction of the party. And that is why it is, you know, this is not just some kind of rhetorical thing. Isn't it great that we're getting small donations? When you get small donations, you don't have to worry about compromising or listening to very wealthy people whose agenda is not the agenda of ordinary Americans.
Well, you're already having an influence on 2020, even if most people don't realize it. Senator Sanders, you introduced single-payer health care. That wasn't new, because you've done it pretty much every year since I've been following you in Congress, even in the House. What was new were the senators that clamored to get behind your bill. And if you notice who they are, they were pretty much anyone in the Senate who wants to have a chance, or so it seems, of being a viable candidate in 2020. I'm talking about Senator Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris of California or even Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. All of these senators who have names that get thrown into the mix for 2020. Single payer has become a bit of a litmus test, thanks to you, Bernie Sanders. Democrats want to be behind it, but it may not play in a general election, and it may go away when whoever wins that primary has to play against President Trump or some other Republican.
Well, Todd, I look at it slightly different. I think the reason members of the House and Senate are getting behind single payer is because the American people are demanding us moving forward. And what the American people are saying, if every other country on earth can guarantee health care to all people as a right, so can we in America. Polls are showing more and more Americans think that that approach makes sense.
Well, it's becoming increasingly clear, Senator, that that argument, that message may play better in a Democratic primary than it ever has before. And I guess this is part of the question for the future of the Democratic Party, because Dems may run on this issue when they're among themselves, thanks largely to you, in a general election. That may have to be abandoned for something that the people in the middle would go for.
Well, I really disagree with that, Todd. I think that when we have the opportunity to explain what we want to do, I think you're going to find a whole lot of people who are not rock-ribbed progressives or Democrats supporting that. The truth is right now that Medicare is the most popular health insurance program in this country. And Medicare is far from perfect. We need to improve it. But people do understand that it is right that our elderly folks are guaranteed health care, good quality health care, freedom of choice with regard to doctors and hospitals. They approve and support Medicare. And I think once we have the opportunity to explain what Medicare for all means, I am really quite confident not only that that is good policy for the country, it will be good politics as well. So I reject the idea that it is just, you know, liberals or progressives who will support Medicare for all. I think you're going to find that over a period of time, a strong majority of the American people supporting that approach.
Senator, I asked on Twitter before our interview and got an overwhelming response. Hey, I'm talking to Bernie Sanders. What should I ask him? And I got thousands of responses, apparently most of them from Democrats. And they sort of went like this. Bernie Sanders is not a member of the party. He refused to join. He's simply causing internal strife. He's hurting the next candidates. He hurt Hillary Clinton. You've heard all of this criticism. But these are not internal DNC party members. These are everyday Dems out there. And I got thousands of them, really, who just said, in a way, why are you talking to him? He's not one of us.
Well, let me just suggest to you that I believe very strongly that if the Democratic Party does not open its ranks to independents, who now constitute a larger percentage of the voting bloc than either Democrats or Republicans, it will be suicidal. I mean, you're talking to somebody who was a member of the Democratic caucus in the House for 16 years. I'm now part of the Democratic leadership, somebody who worked extremely hard to help elect Democrats all over this country, but somebody who does believe that the Democratic Party needs fundamental reform. And I think that at a time when we are taking on not only a disastrous president and a disastrous agenda, but a Republican agenda that is so far out of touch with the needs of ordinary people, is rejected by ordinary people, the Democrats need to do some real soul searching. And I'm going to play an active role in that process, because this is not just some esoterical question about reforming the Democratic Party. This is a question about defeating the most dangerous president in the modern history of this country. And if we don't reform the Democratic Party, and if we don't bring energy into the party, and we don't have grassroots support in the party, I worry about the future. Those are things that have to be done, not just for the Democratic Party, but for the future of America.
Independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You can hear a longer version of my interview with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's all at our website at thetakeaway.org. We're looking at the future of the Democratic and Republican parties over the next 2 weeks. So what do you think your party will look like in the next 20 years?
This is David in North Miami Beach, Florida. In 20 years, the Democrats may vanish as the media and money concentrate and race overwhelms class.
Hey, this is Erica from Louisville. In 20 years, there will be no political parties, only Mad Max-style gangs of raiders.
Reavers and raiders, are we already there? What do you want to see your party stand for? Republicans, remember, we need you here. We're talking about the future of the GOP next week, so give us a call, 8778-MY-TAKE, Republican or Democrat. You can always hit us on Twitter. You have been a lot at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Westbridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, offering a family-centered, integrated approach to treatment for men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders. More at westbridge.org.
No hay luz ni agua.
There's no electricity and no water. It's very difficult.
Pero esperar a que llegue cuando Dios quiera.
We just have to wait until help arrives, God willing.
That's Olga, a resident of Naranjito in Puerto Rico. You can hear Olga's frustration there with the grind of life without the basics and the toll it takes on people struggling to recover. WNYC producer Alana Casanova-Burgess has been reporting from Puerto Rico on the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, and she's found signs of a growing mental health crisis as the trauma of the storm subsides, but the despair of a slow recovery remains.
I've been speaking to professionals here on the island, and they tell me the problem is widespread, and I've also seen it everywhere I go. Dr. Mayra Olavarria, who's a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Puerto Rico, told me that even before the hurricane, mental health services in Puerto Rico were really inadequate for the need. And now, of course, with all the stress and the anxiety that people are experiencing after the storm, there's an additional need to those who were perhaps on medication before Maria. Now there are so many people who are anxious, who are feeling lost, who are unwilling or unable to get aid from the government or from private sources. So she had even spoken to people in Barranquitas, which is a town nearby. She had spoken to people who were showing signs of post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, struggling whenever it rains heavily here, which is frequently, you know, people were being taken right back to the day of the hurricane.
We heard from Olga in the top of our intro, Alana, who was an example of some of that stress and anxiety that you're talking about. What was going on with Olga when you talked to her?
Yeah, we met at a free clinic in Naranjito, and the clinic was full of physicians from New York who were there to provide services. They were not mental health experts, but as soon as we started talking about what her needs were, she started telling me about how these 2 months of not having water, not having electricity are really wearing on her. And you can hear that in her voice. And then there's also a bit of a resignation to the circumstances, that it's become almost normal because it's gone on for so long. And because people are not sure when it will actually end, you know, when little towns like Naranjito are going to get power back. So she was struggling, obviously, with the emotional weight of this and who to talk to and not knowing who to turn to, but then also feeling like, well, what are you going to do? You just have to wait. You just have to keep waiting.
Can you talk about what you learned about people's difficulty in accessing everyday medical care? It's been reported over and over, and we know that people's mental health status is tied so closely to their ability to get care for other health problems, and all of that just gets worse after a disaster.
Absolutely. And at that clinic in Naranjito, where I spoke with Olga, I also spoke with Dr. Diego Poniman. He's with Somos Healthcare, which is an organization based in New York, and he's a physician. So he was not there to do mental health screenings, but he kept hearing from his patients, even with people with serious conditions like cancer, that they had something else on their minds. And here, have a listen to this.
When I told the patients, what do you want to talk about? They were saying, let's talk about my medication, but after a little bit, they switch to depression, anxiety, what's going to happen next.
And obviously, you know, he stressed to me that everything is related. And so because access to all kinds of services is still a challenge, mental health is going to suffer. So here's what he said.
But mental health is key, because if you're a diabetic, if you have hypertension, if you're having depression on top, it's very hard for you to take care of yourself, to take your medication, to go to the follow-ups, or to make all the phone calls, which, by the way, it's very difficult. I don't know if you've noticed, the signals are impossible. So that's what they're telling me. I want to reach out, and it's impossible.
I hear Dr. Diego telling you about the frustrations that his patients have, or the frustration he has in giving them comprehensive care. I wonder how willing people who are struggling to recover are to talk to professionals about their mental health status, or if they dismiss it themselves. We heard so much of that from other disasters as well. People are so busy getting their homes repaired, trying to find a new job, that they don't necessarily attend to their mental health concerns.
Absolutely. And I was in a small town called Las Marias in the west of the island. It's in the mountains. It's known for its sweet oranges and for other agriculture that's really suffered after the storm. And there I ran into Luis Ramirez, who's a clinical psychology PhD student from Ponce Health Sciences University. He was there volunteering. You know, he couldn't actually treat anyone there, but he was giving mental health screenings with a small team from the university. They were asking about appetite and how people's routines had changed in order to refer them to a center about 45 minutes away. And he said that they were facing a stigma issue in Las Marias specifically. So here's what he said.
They still have that stigma. It's like a small town. Everyone knows everyone, so everyone's going to know that you're going to a psychologist. And we have to work with that to convince them to treat their problems, because they're not treating them. They're just assuming that they're sad when they have the full symptoms of a depressive disorder.
Do you have a sense of the bottom line here, just how broad the unmet need is in Puerto Rico right now?
It's almost unfathomable, because remember that it's still raining really heavily in Puerto Rico frequently. So every couple of days, you get an enormous thunderstorm. In places like Las Marias, there are still mudslides. And, you know, Las Marias was cut off from neighboring towns for 15 days after the hurricane. So this stress is ongoing. It's not just that people are dealing with what happened to them after the hurricane, how they lost their homes. It's that every time it rains, every time there's one of these major rainstorms, it's like they're back there where they were before. And again, they look around and they see it's been 2 months and we haven't gotten electricity yet. How much longer can we deal with this? I mean, the bottom line is just that this is an incredibly stressful situation that seems, I see it everywhere I go on the island, every single small town. So it is massive, and it seems just... it seems just an incredible challenge.
Alana Casanova Burgess with WNYC reporting from Puerto Rico. Alana, thanks again.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Officials in Egypt are calling it the deadliest terror attack in their country's modern history. On Friday, Islamist terrorists attacked a crowded mosque in a village in the Sinai Peninsula, killing at least 300 people and injuring scores more. The ease with which the attack was carried out is drawing scrutiny on the Egyptian government's response to the Islamic insurgency in Sinai and whether the government led by President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi can provide security. Declan Walsh is Cairo bureau chief for The New York Times.
We know that there had been a series of warnings from militants in that area against the residents of this village over the last number of months, and particularly in the last couple of weeks, warning them to stop practicing the Sufi form of Islam. Now, experts on militancy say that it would not be unusual for the Islamic State or for their local affiliate perhaps to avoid claiming responsibility for an attack like this, just because it is such a sensitive issue to carry out a massacre of so many Muslims, the largest in Egypt's history, and the potential backlash that might bring. But their goal is to try and sow division, and that's why they had been turned their guns against Orthodox Coptic Christians, and it now appears to be why they have turned their focus onto the country's Sufi community.
Declan, you mentioned the warnings and the threats that had been mounting over the past many months in Sinai for an attack like this. Did the government hear those warnings? Was security stepped up? And is there any sense among residents of this village or in Egypt more broadly that an attack like this could have been prevented because of the warnings?
That's certainly a question that's going to be asked of President Sisi's forces going forward. You know, why their intelligence had not picked up on this threat and why they had failed to anticipate, you know, that it could result in a massacre like this, as well, of course, as the question of how these militants managed to carry out this kind of attack in broad daylight during Friday prayers and apparently escape unimpeded until later that evening, where we had Egyptian warplanes that bombed, as they said, some of the vehicles that were involved in the attack. But it does seem that when this attack was taking place, the attackers took their time. They walked into the mosque after firing some sort of explosives inside. They shot people dead, and then they walked around, as witnesses say, and they looked to see people who are still breathing and executed them. Then they opened fire on the ambulances as the emergency services arrived. So this, you know, certainly from what we know, gives the impression of an attack that was carried out, if not in a relaxed fashion, then certainly, you know, these militants took their time to kill as many people as possible without being challenged. So both on the intelligence front and on the security front, there are going to be questions for the Egyptian government here to answer about how they are fighting Islamic State in the Sinai.
The details are sickening, Declan, but the Sisi government had been accused even before this attack of mishandling the Islamic insurgency in Sinai.
you know, the criticism that experts make of President Sisi's strategy is that it is very distant from the people. They're not bringing the people on board. And then to add to that, there has been a constant rattle of accusations of human rights abuses. There have been instances where the Egyptian military have raised entire villages in order to, as they say it, to ensure security. So it certainly seems to be a very brutal fight on both sides. And the criticism of the government is that it's not doing enough to bring the local people on board to get their help to try and prevent attacks like the one we saw on Friday.
So Declan, if the broader strategy behind these attacks on Coptic Christians, on Sufi Muslims, is to sow divisions in Egyptian society, what is the government doing to counteract that message?
Well, certainly President Sisi has been a very staunch supporter of the Christian community after those attacks against Coptic churches earlier this year. And obviously now that Muslims have been attacked, there are an estimated 15 million Egyptians who practice the Sufi form of Islam. It's very likely that he will stand in solidarity with them.
Declan Walsh, thank you for the update.
My pleasure.
Declan Walsh is Cairo Bureau Chief for the New York Times.
Welcome back.
Members of Congress are back in Washington today. Republicans dedicated to the proposition of getting massive corporate tax cuts done by the new year. How massive? Well, along with everything else, Republicans want to cut corporate taxes from 35% now down to 20%. And Republicans say that lower corporate taxes mean more jobs and higher wages, but do those figures really add up? And what impact do corporate tax cuts have in the real world? Rebecca Kaiser is a visiting professor at Fordham University School of Law and a professor at Brooklyn Law School.
Historically, there's not much evidence supporting the conclusion that higher post-tax profits lead to increased investment. But even if rate cuts boost savings and investment, there is a growing decoupling between productivity growth and wage growth. So we could see the former without the latter. But the hope is certainly that as a result of this rate cut, corporations will invest more, and this will help grow the economy.
That makes it sound like it's less and less likely that if big companies get to keep more money, that money will trickle down and provide more jobs for working people.
That's certainly a possibility. Nothing in the cut requires corporations to use money for jobs. What they will do with the money depends on the industry, and they'll presumably put the money in investments that they estimate will reap the most rewards to shareholders. So this may mean hiring workers or building robots. It's really an industry-specific calculation. We also have to ask how the legislation is paid for. Here, the corporate tax cut is generally going to be financed by increasing deficits. So there may be increased incentives to invest, but these will be dampened somewhat by deficit effects and perhaps substantially. This is because increased deficits push up interest rates, which will tend to discourage investment.
All right. So what do we know about debt finance tax cuts like this? I mean, this one is huge. And again, I keep our attention on whether middle class people, working people are going to see the flourishing and the blossoming of employment that's being promised by Republicans in Washington here.
We don't have a ton of experience with this because typically when we've had tax cuts, we haven't been in the same situation with so much outstanding debt. Most mainstream economic models take into account the drag by that debt and as a result substantially reduce the likelihood that this will lead to a lot of increased investment.
All right, but Rebecca, aren't corporate profits already near record highs? Why would anyone think that more cash or being able to keep even more profit would mean more employment?
Well, the idea is that this will lead corporations to build more plants and invest in more assets. One thing also to keep in mind here is that this is against the background of what other countries have done with their statutory corporate rates. Ours remains pretty high. And so what this does is it induces companies to engage in costly and inefficient and really abusive tax avoidance to bring down their effective tax rate, meaning the rate that they actually pay. So what this does is hopefully reduce those incentives. And so in this manner, perhaps companies can use their resources more wisely, not just for tax planning. Whether it actually accomplishes that goal is another story.
Rebecca, I get the argument that lower taxes for corporations gives them more cash on hand, more cash for investment, and they can grow the economy that way. But there's another statistic that's just staring us in the face. Corporate America is sitting on $2 trillion in cash reserves right now. And so that forces us to ask the question, why isn't that money being used for investment that leads to employment? How much more would lead to that kind of investment?
You know, companies are trying to make investment decisions, and they're trying to see what is the most effective way to earn a good return for their shareholders. And that does not necessarily mean more jobs. And so I think that's also against the background of the fact that the economy is close to full employment. So having a tax cut in this time of full employment will arguably not really result in more jobs.
Rebecca Kaiser, visiting professor at Fordham University School of Law and professor at Brooklyn Law School. Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us today on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Pope Francis is in Myanmar for a three-day visit now, where he'll meet with people from the Catholic minority. And while the world watches to see how the Pope will directly address atrocities against Rohingya Muslims, hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have been forced from their homes after crackdowns by the Burmese military. The military says that response is one to Rohingya militants. The U.S. last week officially declared the Myanmar government's strategy ethnic cleansing. Documentarian Shafir Rahman is working on two films about the crisis in Myanmar, and he says the Burmese story of the October crackdowns against the Rohingya don't match the evidence.
The Burmese narrative is that this was a response to the attacks by the Rohingya militants on the 24th, and this was a response that happened on the 25th. But what we see is troop deployment across Rakhine well before the date. We also see that in places which had nothing to do with the 32 check posts which were attacked, these places also saw troop deployment and indeed clearance operations. And the third piece of evidence is that there are massacres which have yet to hit the press, which have yet to hit the media, which took place before the 25th.
So what does that mean in terms of the story that the West thinks it's being told about what's really going on in Myanmar?
It's a very easy handle, isn't it, to say that we're dealing with Rohingya terrorists and therefore this operation of ours is in defense of the state. But if we look at the history, not just the history which started in October of 2016 when the first recent clearance operations took place, but if we go back in history, if we start in 1978 and the 200,000 people who were made refugees then, and then in 1991, 1992 when there were 250,000 people. So we see a pattern. And this pattern is undeniably one of clearing Rakhine of Rohingya people.
Have you been able to put this strategy, the pre-planning and the intention behind it, to any Burmese military officials? Have they acknowledged it?
Their response was simple, that the instances that we brought up, there was a hive of ARSA activity and we responded. And anything else, they, of course, completely deny it. Even in September of this year, Aung San Suu Kyi was saying that she's not quite sure why the Rohingya are leaving. A month later, a Burmese government official was saying, well, we think that the Rohingya pre-planned this, meaning their exit. So we have these absurd and outrageous comments by not only the de facto head of state, but also her junior officials saying, well, we don't know what this is all about.
And it's a narrative that's never really been challenged in the West. Is that just because nobody's bothered to double check the story or get a clearer story? Or do you sense complicity?
So I think they've been getting a little bit of a free pass here. And slowly, I think it's sinking in. I think some heads of state, like, for example, France, they have called it genocide. And of course, in the U.S., Mr. Tillerson has said, well, there is evidence of ethnic cleansing. So I think the critical mass, we're reaching that point where people are saying that, hang on a minute, something's gone seriously wrong here.
Your journalism took you to a village called Tulatoli. What did you find there?
I didn't get to Tulatoli. I met people who were crossing the border. And I have to tell you, Todd, that really the savagery that these people told me was just indescribable.
Can you describe some of it? Tell us what you heard.
What happened on that fateful day, August the 30th, is that the military arrived at 8 a.m. in the morning. This chairman, Oinko Singh, told the villagers, they might set fire to the houses, but just gather at the riverbank and you'll be fine. The army did indeed set fire to the houses, and then they went straight to the riverbank. Many people were shot at the riverbank. Women were then taken, five by five, to huts, where they were raped, knocked out, and then the huts were locked and then torched. So they were burned alive. In my film about this massacre, I also show one woman who describes how her baby was torn from her and just flung into the fire. And of course, the baby died. She was then taken with her three other children into the hut. She was raped. The children were knocked out. The oldest one managed to regain consciousness, managed to wake her mum up, and then exit the building. And that's why we know the story about her experiences that morning in Tulatuli.
More broadly, as this catastrophe has unfolded in Myanmar, what's the untold story of Rohingya women?
If you look at what's been happening to Rohingya men have been leaving Rakhine State for some time. Rohingya women were not part of this original, if you like, outflow of people. That changed because of the targeting of Rohingya women by soldiers. And we're not just talking about rape, we're talking about other forms of targeting as well. It's very difficult to marry if you're a Rohingya couple. If you have a child and you want to register the birth of the child, it's extremely difficult. And the consequence of which is that you're denied healthcare, you're denied education, you're denied all sorts of support that a citizen might anticipate. What you have here is, in these clearance operations, a definitive strategy by the military to rape women. It's used as a tactic of war. Aung San Suu Kyi herself, some years ago, she said, yes, the army does use rape as a tactic of war. Now that she's in power, her own website says that all these reports of rapes are fake, and these are fake rapes. This is all fake news. So that's what Rohingya women have been experiencing.
Shafir, Western attention on this catastrophe is starting to build. You mentioned it. We've been covering it for months on this show. Why do you think they've been allowed to continue?
The nice narrative is that here is Aung San Suu Kyi, a beautiful pro-Western woman who has defied the military. She comes to power and Burma will have a glowing future. And that's the kind of narrative that everyone wanted. And everyone heaped prizes upon her. But that's not the case. That's not what has happened. And perhaps those self-serving interests don't really have any space for Rohingya, who are, if you like, in the way.
Shafir Rahman is a documentary filmmaker who's been covering the catastrophe of the Rohingya in Myanmar. Shafir Rahman, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much indeed, Todd.
Amy Milan is a member of the band Stars and Broken Social Scene.
Crying in the street.
You're listening to Amy Milan there from Star's latest album, There Is No Love in Fluorescent Light. Amy Milan sings. She plays guitar and piano for her bands, but she's also exploring the technical side of music making, doing some engineering and producing. She helped engineer a few of the demos for this most recent album that you're listening to. But one thing that Amy noticed, there are very few women behind the boards in audio production, professionals or dabblers or otherwise, and she wants to do something about it. I asked Amy to take me back to what she remembered from the first time she walked into a recording studio.
Like a million knobs. And I still don't believe they all do something. You know, I just don't really buy it. I mean, it's a very special experience when you, it still is. You know, I still get that feeling that something magical is going to happen.
Magical, but were you the only woman that day, the first time you walked in there?
That's always the case.
Always.
It's always been the case. And if you look at the awards, like we have our kind of quote-unquote Grammys. It's always funny to say the Canadian comparisons of American things, but it's called the Junos. And if you look at like the history of the category of producer and engineer, generally 99% of all nominees and winners have been men.
All nominees and winners have been men, but that's reflecting the fact that behind the scenes, most of the board ops, most of the engineers, and the vast majority of the producers themselves are men. So what's behind that? Not just in Canada, obviously in the United States. There's a cultural divide here in music production and rock and roll. Why? Why are there no women in these fields?
Well, I mean, that's a huge question. I don't know if I can have all the answers to, but it is actually getting worse. Like there has been a 70% decline in women going into STEM type places and universities. So I think one of the reasons is representation. So it's the chicken or the egg thing, right? So it's like you don't see yourself there. So you don't even imagine yourself doing that. On the darker side, I think that sometimes harassment has played a part in kind of intimidating women out of the programs. But essentially, what I am trying to do is trying to see how we can change it. So I started working, talking to mostly this company called Women's Audio Mission out of San Francisco. And they're very inspiring. And they have been trying to change this for the past 17 years. Their big mission is to target young girls because they feel like that is the biggest payoff. Because kind of when you're in your 20s, you already have an idea of what you want to do. So they're trying to get girls between the ages of 13 and 17 into the control rooms and having experience there and then and getting inspired by that. And then they've since put thousands of women into the workforce.
So what is this for you, though, Amy? Is this just a question of, hey, I love doing this. This is so much fun. This is a great profession and more women and girls should be doing it? Or is it an issue of equality and equity for you? Or is it both of those things?
It's both of those things. But really, it kind of began by accident. Really, I'm quite lazy and I love to lunch. But I was at home in between tours and the Junos, which I was speaking of, put out on Twitter their latest nominees. This was back in 2015. So one of their campaigns was to put a photograph with each category. And every photograph that was coming up was all men. And I was actually really taken aback. I couldn't really believe it. And it was much different when you saw the actual photograph as opposed to just the names, I guess because I wasn't really paying attention to the names and photos have more of an effect. Mm. And so I was sitting at home, literally just folding laundry, and I just started re-tagging it, and I made a hashtag JunoSoMale. And it was right on the tail of Oscar So White. And so, I was just at home. Like, it's amazing the power of Twitter sometimes, because within an hour, every publication across the country had picked up my hashtag and put it along with announcing all the nominees. So it became an issue. They picked up on it, and it was a hot button right away. I was on the phone with the head of Keras, who is the guy who runs the Junos, within 3 hours, and talking about how we can make a change, because it's so unbalanced, and it really is about equity.
Right. So that means then that for you primarily, this is a question of equity.
Absolutely.
And a profession that you love, and you'd like to see other women and girls enjoying it too.
Yeah, I think that it's when you walk into a room and you see both sexes represented, you feel like you're there. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't know if you do because you're a white guy,
right,
so
right.
You see yourself everywhere. But
almost everywhere.
So, and also jobs, you know, it's important for women to have more opportunity to work.
Tell me a little bit about being a producer on a record. The artist comes in, she has a guitar, she has her songs written, she has a great voice. That's not the final product, usually, of what gets on a record.
What I love about production is actually the tricks. Take, you know, a can and fill it with beans and then swirl it around and put like tons of different reverbs on it. And then it sounds like some kind of archaic drum. You know, those are the kind of things that I love to play with in the studio. And that's, I think, the most fun, being able to just go into a room filled with microphones and seeing which one that your voice loves. I mean, I don't know if you've chosen your own microphone for your job here, but have you?
No, I actually had pitched a more of a Fisher Price sound, kind of a children's
which
Fisher
can also
Price.
Be fun. Beck well, loves that stuff.
Yeah, I know he does, and they won't let me do it.
Yeah, so that's always really interesting to me to see how different voices work with different kind of microphones, and sometimes the cheaper ones actually fall in love with your voice more than Neumann will. But yeah, it's really just play. That's what's so fun about pop music.
So tell me a little more about Women's Audio Mission and exactly what they do to get all of these girls interested in engineering, mixing, and producing, and how they're getting them out into the world.
Well, so they started in San Francisco, and they have a few different programs that they do. One is Girls on the Mic, which inspires over 1,000 Bay Area girls between the ages of 11 and 18 a year to inspire them to do music production. They have studios within their house that they built, and then they also do core training, which provides certificates to women, older women between the ages of 19 and whoever wants to come to training in professional recording studios for 500 Bay Area women. And what I'm trying to do is get something WHAM-inspired in Canada. And the thing about these things is it always takes money, right? Like, it's always about funding. Being able to afford to bring the women from Women's Audio Mission to Canada, you know, put them up, find rooms that will allow them to record. So what I'm concentrating on right now is being able to find some different funding. And they're always looking for funding. So if you are just like, oh, I feel like giving my money away today, I would just inspire you to go to Women's Audio Mission online and donate. And yeah, so they basically put, you know, over 1,000 women in work for Google, for Tracy Chapman. There's Comedy Central. There's engineers that have hired through them. So they're just doing incredible work that is very inspiring to me.
Amy Milan with Stars and Broken Social Scene. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
The clock chimes in an empty room. I can feel you moving away. Come out to the garden where the lilacs bloom. There is something that I need to say.
Star's latest album, There Is No Love in Fluorescent Light, came out last month. At the start of today's show, I spoke with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders about the future of the Democratic Party. And over the next couple of weeks, we're exploring where the Democratic and Republican parties are headed. But we don't just want to hear from senators and party bosses. We also want you.
This is Kim Fuse from Petaluma, California. We could very well have a multiple party system in 20 years. The paramount issues for all will be surviving climate change. The disasters, famines, and wars rising from these changes will be our greatest challenge.
We want to hear from you. Tell us what you think your party's going to look like in 20 years. What do you want to see your party stand for? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always comment on our Facebook page and be part of our coverage over the next 2 weeks on the future of the Democratic and Republican parties. Until then, thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.